Welcome to KiteLine, a weekly radio program on WFHB that focuses on issues in Indiana's prison system and beyond.
I'm Emma Johnson.
And I'm Mia Beach.
And we're your hosts for this program. Behind the prison walls, a message is called a kite. Whispered words, a note passed hand to hand, or requests submitted to guards for medical care. Illicit or not, sending a kite means trusting that other people will bear it farther along until it reaches its destination. On KiteLine, we hope to pass along those words across the prison walls.
First off, we have some regional and national news.
On August 18th, the Justice Department announced that it was scaling back the use of private prisons for the federal system. By spring 2017, the number of prisoners caged in private facilities will drop from the current 30,000 to 14,200. The decision was framed as a first step toward phasing out private prison contractors entirely, though no definite commitments on a timeline have been made. The Justice Department made it clear that it was also taking advantage of a slight drop in the overall number of federal prisoners to make the cost-saving measure, given the expense and inefficiency of private prisons. On the other hand, the Justice Department pointed to a series of uprisings in privatized facilities, such as a riot involving 250 inmates at the private Adams County Correctional Center in Mississippi in 2012, as a central argument for the decision. Behind the dry debate about efficiency is the reality of prisoners' resistance and the constant pressure it imposes on the prison system.
As heard recently on WFHB's Daily Local News, the City of Bloomington recently adopted new rules that dramatically increased the cost of accessing footage from police body cameras and dash cams. Formerly $20, the new standard fee to obtain footage is $150 per officer. The ACLU has often voiced its support for widespread adoption of this technology, heralding body cameras as a win-win as long as civilian privacy remained properly protected. However, with the new fee increase, this also makes access to footage much less attainable for many Bloomington residents who are regularly affected by the police. For this episode, we return to more from the prison ecology panel that we aired in the previous episode.
My name's Jasmine Heiss. I'm a senior campaigner for Individuals at Risk at Amnesty International's U.S. section. And what that very long title means is just that I work on behalf of individuals who lie at the heart of Amnesty's human rights issues. So in many cases, right, that means prisoners, both in the United States and around the world. But it also means people who have been tortured. It also means environmental rights defenders. It means people who have been disappeared or forcibly killed by the government for whom we're campaigning for accountability, et cetera. So in that capacity, particularly here in the US, I've had the tremendous privilege to work on cases like that of the Angola 3. Of Robert King, Herman Wallace, and Albert Woodfox. I just got off the phone with Albert, actually, and he's getting ready to celebrate King's birthday in New Orleans, which is a pretty amazing phone call to have. It also means that I've had the privilege of being part of the work to pass the first reparations ordinance for police torture survivors here in the United States just about a year ago. Yes, let's clap for that. That's a pretty big deal in the U.S., reparations. We worked with local advocates and particularly torture survivors themselves to pass an ordinance in Chicago that, using international human rights law where domestic law failed, was a reparations package for at least 100 people who had been tortured in between the early 70s and early 90s at the hands of John Birch and the people under his command. I also work on behalf of people who are imprisoned in other countries. One case that has been in the media a lot lately is Raif Badawi, who is a Saudi Arabian blogger. And so in that capacity, one of the things that I do the most is press the US government to hold allies like Saudi Arabia accountable and to put human rights at the center of foreign policy rather than privileging arms sales and oil wealth. And so that's a little bit about what I do. I'm really excited and happy to be in this room personally because who I am fundamentally outside of my role at Amnesty is someone who came to social justice and movement work through environmental work. I grew up in a house run off of solar and wind with no hot water in northern Michigan, and the first demonstrations I ever remember going to were Earth Day marches. So I think that this is such a timely and important moment to talk about the intersections of these two struggles, particularly when President Obama is seeking to leave this legacy of criminal justice reform. And I'm really humbled and honored to be with all of you tonight.
And that one's a hard to follow.
Yeah.
My name's Eric McDavid. I got out of prison January before last, so 2015, after serving 5 days short of 9 years. I was originally sentenced to just short of 20 years for conspiracy to use explosives against government property and interstate commerce with the terrorism enhancement, which is the reason why I got almost 20 years. Yeah, pretty much just a recently freed political prisoner due to ground anarchist support from folks putting in years of time and effort and doing FOIAs and doing appeals and like changing the power dynamics with the legal system and utilizing a more synergistic approach and more authentic approach. That's it.
For those of you who don't know about Leonard Peltier is a 71-year-old who has been incarcerated for more than 4 decades. That anniversary was marked earlier this year for a crime that there is no available evidence that he committed. That is a fact that the US government no longer disputes. They say there is no available evidence that you committed this crime. And yet, all of his available legal remedies have been exhausted. He's lost at multiple appeal hearings, and he's repeatedly been denied parole based on the fact that he will not admit culpability for a crime for which there is no available evidence that he committed. Now, you alluded a bit to the crime that he is in prison for. Two FBI agents were killed at Pine Ridge Reservation, which spans the Dakotas, in 1975. Now, at that time, right, he was a leading member of the American Indian Movement, which came to prominence at the same time as the Panthers, and was waging the same basic struggle for the survival of a people that the Panthers were waging. In the lead up to the firefight on Pine Ridge, at which Leonard was killed, the FBI was already gearing up for a major confrontation with AIM activists on Pine Ridge. At that point, they had already marched to Washington, D.C. and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they had occupied a Wounded Knee in recognition of the tragedy that was committed there previously. And so I'm sure that many of you have seen the COINTEL lists of extremist organizations and troublemakers, or actually rabble-rousers, as they were called at that time by COINTELPRO and the FBI. AIM activists were on that list, including Leonard Peltier. And in the lead up to this shootout, an estimated 65 plus people had been killed or disappeared by paramilitary squads, allegedly connected to the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs government. Now, there's no way to actually tangibly connect the funding for these paramilitaries to BIA, because at that time, the federal government was giving the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the local tribal leadership money for highway grants. There was absolutely no documentation about how that money was being spent, and they were allegedly, right, probably using that money to set up paramilitary organizations that reported directly to BIA leadership. And so when two FBI officers pursued an unnamed suspect onto Pine Ridge Reservation, AIM leaders thought that they were about to be killed, which was a reasonable thing to think given the number of people who had been killed in the previous years. And so gunfire was exchanged. Three people died that day. Two FBI agents, whose names have been repeated, and a Native person, whose name is never repeated, and there's never been any justice for his case. However, two people were prosecuted for killing the FBI agents. Both people were acquitted based on the fact that the jury thought that they could reasonably believe that their lives were at risk, given the climate of terror and fear on the reservation. When that happened, Leonard Peltier was extradited from Canada, where he had fled because he feared for his life and for his inability to access justice in this country, based on affidavits that the FBI later admitted they knew were perjured. And the woman, Myrtle Poorbear, who gave those affidavits, said that she did it only after she had been followed and harassed for months by FBI agents. And this was a woman whose mental health was also unstable and who struggled with substance abuse. And so again, we see a pattern in this case, right, of the law enforcement officers preying on the most vulnerable people over and over again to pursue their version of justice, despite the fact that there was no available evidence that Leonard Peltier had committed this crime. Over the course of the trial, there were multiple additional miscarriages of justice. The two other key eyewitnesses for the FBI later said that they were pressured into testifying and recanted. Potentially exculpatory evidence, ballistics evidence specifically, that showed that the gun used to kill the FBI agents could not have been Leonard Peltier's, was suppressed. All of these issues coming together, right, around this four-decade miscarriage of injustice, illuminate a system in which it was completely improbable and impossible for this person to access the equal justice under law that's promised on the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, despite the fact that he was repeatedly rejected at appeal hearings, that he repeatedly lost, one of the judges who presided over a later appeal hearing, Judge Heaney, wrote a letter eventually saying that he thought that the issues surrounding this trial were so troubling that they merited consideration for leniency later in the case, specifically parole, right? That's what he's talking about here. However, because Leonard will not admit that he killed FBI agents, the parole board has repeatedly denied him, despite also saying, we recognize that there's no available evidence that you did this. So now we're at a point in this moment where Leonard is 71 years old. He is incarcerated at USP Coleman, the max in USP Coleman specifically, thousands of miles from his friends and his family. He's very sick. He has an abdominal aortic aneurysm, which, if treated, can be managed relatively easily, but if it ruptures, there is a 90% chance of mortality. And the Bureau of Prisons has still told us, well, we're waiting to see how big it is before we operate again. This despite the fact that a 71-year-old man is in a maximum security prison where he could at any moment, right, by a guard or another inmate, be in a physical altercation which could cause it to rupture. When I visited him last, he said, Jasmine, listen, the prison guards and the medical staff, they walk when there's an emergency. If this ruptures, I'm going to die on the stretcher, leaving the prison for the prison hospital. I'm not going to make it. Right now, this is just a bit of medical background. We know that when it was first found, the AAA, abdominal aortic aneurysm, was at 5 centimeters by 4.5 centimeters. They gave him another MRI about a month ago, and they still haven't released the results to Leonard, to his lawyers, or to any of the advocates working on his behalf. And so we have no way of knowing how grave his risk is right now, but every time I talk to him, he's afraid he's going to die. Now that's a pretty grave portrait of why things are so bad right now, right? But I think that this is also a moment in which we have an opportunity. Unfortunately, as Leonard's health is failing, we're also coming to the end of President Obama's time in office, which means we're coming to the moment where if he is going to grant executive clemencies, it's going to be between now and January 20th. Now, there has been a much needed and long overdue movement toward criminal justice reform, which has been championed in various ways by both sides of the aisle, right? And with that, we've seen more clemencies, more commutations and pardons than the previous seven presidents combined. However, this has a relatively narrow purview, which is an important purview, but defines Leonard out of that class of people that the president has committed to addressing. Because of Clemency Project 2014 and the commitment to address nonviolent drug offenders, President Obama is looking very hard at those cases. Now that process, as I'm sure many of you know, is frankly a disaster and has been so under-resourced and underfunded that the previous pardons attorney quit. saying that, you know, there wasn't enough resources, that there were going to be thousands of cases that were meritorious, that were simply never going to be looked at. And even today, when we look at the clemency process and who is getting writs of clemency, there's no sense of where these are coming from or who the political influencers are that are ultimately moving these cases. And so this, to me, brings a larger question into relief as well, right? When we think about nonviolent drug offenses, it's incredibly important to place that in the context of the war on drugs and the way that that has put mass incarceration in this country into overdrive. However, there's also, I think, a question of what violence means when you're prosecuting people in the US criminal justice system. What does it mean that Leonard Peltier was convicted of a violent crime when he was convicted in a moment where the violence surrounding his community and the communities of Native people across the United States was so pervasive that people were literally struggling for their lives every day? Beyond that, when we look at sentencing practices in this country, we know that people are charged as violent offenders if the police come and there's a gun in the same room as cocaine, right? That's insane. That's insane. And so when we're looking at this case, calling for Leonard Peltier to be granted clemency, we also need to be asking for a more comprehensive look at what criminal justice reform means so that we're not saying, oh yes, we're doing great. This country has decarcerated a ton of people. The people who are still inside, they can be left there because they're the bad ones. They're the violent ones. We need to be pushing for more and calling for more. And Leonard's case is emblematic of the need to look beyond these narrow purview of reform and say, okay, we'll compromise on getting rid of mandatory minimums. We're good on that. Let's increase the max and let's really go after kingpins and violent offenders. And then the other thing that this really calls into relief for me, right, again, is the intersection between the struggle for environmental justice and the struggle for political prisoners and for criminal justice reform in this country. And to illuminate that, I'm going to tell you one of my personal favorite recent stories about Leonard. So my good friend, who I'm sure many of you know, she's an Earth Firster and a fantastic kick-ass lawyer and organizer, Emily Posner, reached out to Leonard because she was looking at Letcher Prison and trying to figure out, you know, who are the people who could potentially be transferred to Letcher that we can get to tell their stories. And so she reached out to Leonard, and Leonard said, I'm very interested in helping you with your issue, and it's definitely something that affects me, but I also need you to be my lawyer and act on my behalf. And I was talking on the phone to her, and I was like, Emily, you're a hell of an organizer, but you just got out organized. That's what just happened. And so, you know, what that sort of illuminates for me, right, is that the people who are in jails and prisons in the United States are not only the people who are going to bear the highest cost of environmental injustice, degradation, of horrible projects like the Letcher Prison, but they're also the people with the most to offer. I mean, you can look at this panel and say, I would say people who have been inside are the best organizers and the best lawyers that I know, hands down. Amazing. And so when we think about that, you know, this is a struggle with which the voices of the people who have the most at stake need to be constantly elevated. And the voices of the people who have the most at stake need to be free to speak, which means that people like Leonard Peltier, who can talk about the very foundations of the intersections between Native rights, environmental rights, and criminal justice and unequal protection of law, need to be out from behind prison bars, because those are the people who should be leading our movements.
You can hear KiteLine by tuning into 91.3 South Central Indiana, 98.1 FM Bloomington, 100.7 FM Nashville, Brown County, 106.3 FM Ellettsville, or our episodes are also available at wfhb.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And now here's more from former prisoner Eric McDavid.
I'm an anarchist, so I'm not a leader. I can talk about intersectionality and my prison experience, definitely, and definitely wish that people feel motivated and empowered by those experiences that I get to share. Oh, let's see, intersectionality. It's a huge concept. Starting off from like where I'm at, in order to provide a bit of a foundation, I was in about 3.5, a little over 3.5 years at FCI Victorville Medium 2, which is just outside of Adelanto, California. It's on a Superfund site. It's a whole complex, actually. There's the USP, which is a penitentiary, two mediums, and a female camp in that complex. And it's all built on a Superfund site, which is an old military dump, pretty much. You can look across the street from the yard and see a whole housing complex, like a massive old military housing complex, completely abandoned because of the toxicity. The dust clouds that go up there, they're unescapable. The water, everyone knows, is toxic, but it's just the water that you gotta drink and bathe in and have your food prepared in. And so that was fun, but not really. After that, I went to Terminal Island, which sits in the port of Long Beach. And we can imagine what the waters of that port look like. And it's pretty porous, and the water there smells funny, tastes funny. It's what you get to shower in, it's what you get to eat with. So in Sacramento County, where I did 28 months of isolation, that's a whole different box of beans, but the water there isn't pretty either. And so like, that conversation happens on a daily basis in prisons, from my experience. Everyone talks about it, everybody knows about it. Everybody feels weird some days. Some days you're fine. And like, when I got out, I was lucky enough to have a friend who did like a blood analysis on me, and my copper was like through the roof. It was like 40 times higher than what it should have been, and like had to detox from that with a very specific regimen for about 9 months to be able to get it back down. And so, I don't know, it's a trip. There's this huge intersection to where, and it's just this unconscious thing where like there's these people just off in these places. We don't see them. I mean, you might drive, if you're driving across country, you might see some lights off in the distance and just wonder what the devil's making that much light. Well, it's just because they've got these huge towers of light shining down on the compound 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. You don't really see it. But they're out of the way, out of our purview, out of the general consciousness, because they're not supposed to be there, because all we're supposed to have is what's on the little box in our hands and getting to work, paying bills, getting food, prepping for our kids. And so like that conversation would happen every day. You talk to all sorts of different folks. You talk to Bises, you talk to homies, you talk to Crips, you talk to Bloods. You talk to, oh, geez, what is it? DC's, Gangster Disciples. You talk to Natives, you talk to Islanders. Everybody's just right there. I mean, it's just not like this kind of like tip-top conversation we were just talking about, yada yada. It's like, man, this shit is messed up. And like, I know that I'm going to be impacted by this, and you're going to be impacted by this, and so how are we going to dance with this? And like, what's going on with it? And so those conversations do happen in prison, and I mean, but it's isolated in a sense too, because a lot of the folks in there don't have the outreach, mm-hmm. don't have the expansion that's available to us out here. Everyone's isolated, everyone's shut down. And so we look at how those folks also got there, how those homies, how the Bloods and Crips and Islanders all got there. And you see the same tactics that the police are using nowadays. Well, those same tactics are the ones that the COINTELPRO folks have been doing since goddess knows when. I mean, you got infiltration, you got entrapment, you got coercion, and you got pressuring people. Mike Cody did 9 months in the hole and finally snapped and flipped. Mm-hmm. Everybody breaks. doesn't excuse it, but everybody breaks. And so these types of pressures and these types of impact that people end up taking on is like coming from these government agencies that we say we support, that we pay taxes to, and that we end up nourishing, like, I mean, to put it any other way, simple. Mm-hmm. And so, like, taking a look at where these impacts come from and why they're there, and asking those really simple questions kind of starts a domino effect. And I know that a lot of the folks in this room have felt that domino effect. They haven't just seen it. They've been impacted by it. But that's not to say that everybody has. And so, yeah, there is this huge intersection and commonality that all these different folks have. And it's just pure and simple. I mean, we're dealing with oppression. Pure and simple. And the really weird part is that it's not just the people on this panel that are dealing with oppression and having to live with it every day. Everyone in this room is oppressed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's heavy, and it's hard, and it hurts when you feel it, when you open yourself up to it, when you realize that it's sitting in you. And it's there for everybody. But that's something that we can coalesce around as well. Mm-hmm. That's a commonality. It may not be a happy one. It may not be something to dance about right now. But it's something to move with. Well, I used that word, didn't I? It's something to kind of understand and gain a perspective around. Something to orientate to. Something to find common ground with. Something to take a step from and with, because it ain't gonna leave. It's gonna be right there with us for generations. Like it or not. I don't like it, but that's part of the truth. Like, it ain't gonna be our kids, but it might be theirs or theirs. That's what the step is for.
Kiteline wants your feedback. You can reach us via email at kitelineradio@gmail.com or find us on Facebook. Are you someone affected by the prison system? If you or a family member have a story you want shared on the program, please email us at kitelineradio@gmail.com. We also welcome you to record something for us to put on the air. To record a message for the show or to send a message to a family member or loved one who's currently behind the walls of an Indiana prison, please call 812-269-2512 and record your message.
You can also write to us at Kiteline Radio, P.O. Box 2422, Bloomington, Indiana, 47402. You can also visit our website at kitelineradio.noblogs.org.
The Midwest Pages to Prisoners Project is an all-volunteer effort that strives to encourage self-education among prisoners in the United States. To get involved, we encourage you to come to their volunteer hours to learn more. The volunteer hours are Sunday, 2 to 5 p.m., Monday, 6 to 9 p.m., Tuesday, 12 to 3 p.m., Wednesday, 3:30 to 6 p.m., and Thursday, 6 to 9 p.m. More information about Pages to Prisoners, donating, or helping out can be found at pagestoprisoners.org. Kiteline is solely responsible for the content here on the show. The views expressed on Kiteline do not necessarily express the opinions of WFHB, its contributors, or any affiliates airing this program. This has been Kiteline on WFHB. Join us every Friday evening at 5:30 for news stories and discussion regarding prison and its impact on our communities. Thanks for listening.